From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Illinois Senator Barack Obama woke up today as the first African-American president-elect of the United States. The historic presidential race between Obama and Senator John McCain ended last night when Senator Obama captured 349 electoral votes. He will become the 44th president of the United States.
The road ahead will be long. Our climb will be steep. We may not get there in 1 year or even in one term. But America, I have never been more hopeful than I am tonight that we will get there. I promise you, we as a people will get there.
Before Senator Obama gave his acceptance speech, Senator John McCain took the stage to officially and graciously concede.
And my heart is filled with nothing but gratitude for the experience and to the American people for giving me a fair hearing before deciding that Senator Obama and my old friend, Senator Joe Biden, should have the honor of leading us for the next 4 years.
This race was one of the longest and most contentious in modern U.S. history. Both candidates worked tirelessly to convince voters they were the best equipped to lead the country into a new and uniquely challenging era. From the beginning, Senator Obama focused his message on hope and change.
You have shown what history teaches us. That at defining moments like this one, the change we need doesn't come from Washington. Change comes to Washington.
Senator McCain declared himself a maverick within his Republican Party and reminded voters that he spent years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam.
Then I found myself falling toward the middle of a small lake in the city of Hanoi with two broken arms, a broken leg, and an angry crowd waiting to greet me.
In the end, the collapsing economy, combined with Senator Obama's core message of change, resonated with the majority of the electorate. A record number of Americans came out to vote on Election Day, with an estimated 136.6 million people casting ballots. Few questioned that race and gender affected the presidential contest, including the marked increase in the black vote, with an African American on the ballot for the first time. This election also marked only the second time in American history that a woman, Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin, was on the ballot for a major party.
I was just your average hockey mom and signed up for the PTA. I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
Last night was the culmination of a formal contest that began 21 months ago.
I chose to run for president at this moment in history because I believe deeply that we cannot solve the challenges of our time unless we solve them together.
Obama was considered an underdog at the beginning of his campaign. He shocked even his own party when he won the Iowa caucuses.
In lines that stretched around schools and churches, in small towns and in big cities, you came together as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents to stand up and say that we are one nation. We are one people, and our time for change has come.
Obama's victory in Iowa shook his Democratic primary rivals, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton of New York and former Senator John Edwards of North Carolina. The Democratic primary intensified as it moved south. Former President Bill Clinton found himself defending remarks he'd made about Senator Obama that some African Americans felt were patronizing and racist. His wife, Senator Hillary Clinton, was forced to respond during a debate.
You talked about Ronald Reagan being a transformative political leader. I did not mention his name.
Your husband did.
Well, I'm here. He's
okay,
not.
Well, and I can't tell who I'm running against sometimes.
Well.
Senator Obama went on to win the South Carolina primary. Then he had to face a new controversy. Critics confronted the senator with questions about his relationship with his controversial former church pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Obama responded by delivering a landmark speech on race.
I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe.
But in fact, the senator did later disown his former pastor after Reverend Wright made increasingly controversial public comments. As Obama bested his chief rival, Senator Hillary Clinton, some female Democratic voters expressed their dismay that the woman they'd hoped would be the first in the White House was not even offered the vice presidential spot on the ticket. Senator Clinton suspended her campaign. A few months later, at the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado, Senator Obama officially accepted his party's nomination.
I realize that I'm not the likeliest candidate for this office. I don't fit the typical pedigree, and I haven't spent my career in the halls of Washington. But I stand before you tonight because all across America, something is stirring. What the naysayers don't understand is that this election has never been about me. It's about you.
Senator Obama now faced Senator John McCain in the general election in what some voters saw as a battle between new ideas and experience. Obama held a steady lead as the two made their case. Shortly before the first debate, the failure of major financial institutions and the plunge in the stock market shook the country's economy to its core. In the final analysis, most American voters felt that the economy was the most important issue in their vote and that Senator Obama was the best equipped to deal with the financial crisis. To add to the mix, the Obama campaign proved adept at registering and organizing scores of new voters, and his candidacy brought African Americans to the polls in record numbers.
Yes, it actually is my first time voting.
Okay.
And I'm waiting on the line to vote. It's around the corner. This is a good day.
For leaders in the black community who walked the long civil rights road so many years ago, the candidacy and success of the Obama campaign helped redefine politics and make history.
Senator Barack Obama's campaign and election last night emphasized that America is about bringing people together and expanding the rights of all people.
We have witnessed what I like to call a nonviolent revolution in America, a revolution of values, a revolution of ideas.
Many of us at the very beginning didn't believe that this could be possible, and the success of this candidacy is really a challenge to us to keep really fighting and pushing and believing in the possibility of making our lives, our children's lives in this country, the place we dream and hope it can be.
We heard from U.S. Congressman John Lewis of Georgia, U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, and Sherrilyn Ifill, a professor of law at University of Maryland School of Law. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. A bag of cookies after a long, hard day at work, a gallon of ice cream to celebrate that promotion, an extra helping of potato salad or macaroni and cheese. Many of us overindulge from time to time, but when do we cross the line from occasional overeating to food addiction? In a few minutes, we'll talk to a food addiction counselor and a recovering food addict. But first, we've got Marty Lerner. He directs the Milestones in Recovery Eating Disorders program. Hi, Marty.
Hello, good afternoon.
So when does someone cross the line between overeating and food addiction?
It's very similar to other addictions. For instance, if I can borrow an analogy between a heavy social drinker and an alcoholic, you know, there comes a time when someone wakes up in the morning and they look back and they realize instead of their controlling their consumption of alcohol, now the alcohol is controlling themselves. So one of the earmarks of food addiction or any addiction is to find yourself in the quagmire of wanting to not engage in a behavior or consume a substance and finding yourself compelled to do that despite the consequences. So a loss of control is one earmark that delineates someone with a bad habit versus someone who has an addictive process they're involved with.
It sounds like there's a big sliding scale there, as there is with, many legal addictive substances, whether it's smoking, whether it's alcohol, whether it's even sugar. Give me a more concrete example of when you think someone has crossed that line.
Well, it's very difficult when you talk about addictions in terms of a diagnosis. If you're limited to diagnosing a problem in terms of frequency or amount, although many people have tried to do that. So, for instance, when looking at eating disorders or food addiction, most people try to define the difference between someone with a weight disorder and an eating disorder, for instance, in terms of what they weigh. And the truth of the matter is that there's a subjective perspective with all of this, and I would prefer to define an addiction in terms of someone continuing to engage in a behavior despite consequences, and also despite the fact that they may want to stop, but feel that they've crossed a line where they're not in control.
What does this do to your brain if you are someone who, for example, has been spending years eating high-sugar, high-fat foods? Does it change how your brain works?
Well, one of the ways in which we delineate, you know, compulsions and addictions from folks that you know, occasionally overindulge is that the brain chemistry, we don't know whether this predates the onset of the addiction or comes after, sort of chicken or the egg. But we do know from recent research, mostly PET scans, tomography, et cetera, that when you look at the brain chemistry and you map the brain of addicts, there's similarities between, for instance, cocaine addicts and food addicts, specifically the amount of dopamine receptors in the brain are less amongst those with cocaine addiction or in the throes of cocaine addiction, or those in the throes of compulsive overeating. And when you measure brain activity, when someone is ingesting cocaine or ingesting, for instance, sugar, refined carbohydrates, types of substances that radically change blood sugar levels, these are mood or mind-altering, and the evidence of that is you can see highlighted areas of the brain where available dopamine and serotonin levels skyrocket. And in addition to that, insulin levels also are elevated, which results in a rapid rise in blood sugar and then a rapid drop, what some people know as functional hypoglycemia.
Well, Marty, thanks for the information.
Yes, you're welcome.
That was Marty Lerner. He's executive director of Milestones in Recovery Eating Disorders Program. And now we've got two people with experience in treating food addiction and recovering from it. Libby Beer is a food addiction counselor at the Illinois Institute for Addiction Recovery. We also have with us a woman we're going to call Vic. She's a recovering food addict and a member of Overeaters Anonymous. So, Libby and Vic, thanks for coming on.
Hello.
Hi.
Vic, I want to start with you, and I want to be very specific. Give me an example of a day when you completely lost control over your eating.
Okay. It wasn't a day. It was the day before and that day and the next day. But anyway, okay, so I wake up in the morning totally hungover. Dr. Lerner, Marty described very well, you know, having lost control. So I wake up, I feel terrible, and the last thing I want to do, I think, in my rational brain, is eat, because I feel so bad. And yet, I know that if I take one bite of anything, I'll be off and running, and I'm scared. I'm really scared. I'm living a totally isolated life, and I'm because of this food addiction, and I'm scared because I'll do it to myself again. But
let me just ask one thing. When you say hungover, do you mean hungover from overeating or hungover?
Oh, yes, purely overeating.
What's an overeating hangover feel like?
Well, okay, I've just woken up from a night of terrible sweats, tossing and turning because of the excesses in my gut. My head feels like it's stuffed with concrete cotton. Every nerve in my body feels like it's got acid on it. I feel completely demoralized, ugly. I'm also physically bloated, just like stuffed. Hard for me.
I think that you've given us a lot of descriptions.
Okay, great. All right. So now you want to know.
Yeah. What did
next?
Yeah, you were saying that you were afraid to start eating,
okay,
but I'm.
I would be afraid to start eating, but there was nothing else to do because I was dirty. I couldn't fit in my clothes. I had no friends left because I was so isolated with the food. So there was nothing left to do but eat. And I was alone, and that's how I did my eating, alone. And uh, I,
And I could hardly, if I had to be around people, I could hardly wait that they should be gone. So then I would find some food, and I would start eating. And if I stopped eating for 1 second, I might remember something, some way that I couldn't handle life, some awareness of where I was at that moment, sitting alone in a kitchen or on the street or whatever, just eating. And then I would start with eating anything. I was a volume eater. And a typical day would include several half gallons of ice cream, a couple of loaves of bread. Oh, and by the way, all the time that I would be eating, not all the time, but at the beginning when I would start out eating, it would like be a break for my imagination, and I'd sit there stuffing my face and thinking of all the great things I was going to do when I got through eating, what a success I would be. But soon those thoughts would be supplanted because I was just terrorized by what I was doing to myself. It's sort of like having two personalities at once.
Let me, please finish your thought.
Well, I was going to say that part of me was screaming, please stop eating. It hurts so bad. And the other part was oblivious to the hurts, the physical hurts, because the other part was traumatized because I just had to keep eating. And I was so proud of how creative I was with my eating, like I would put a stick of butter on top of a chocolate bar or something like that, and I thought, oh, you're so creative, Vic. Yeah, so you get the idea?
Yeah, I get the idea, and you're very, you paint some very concrete pictures of what you were going through, and I want to get Libby in here. You know, you're a food addiction counselor, Libby, and when you hear Vic talk about, you know, first of all, what she actually consumed, secondly, how it made her body feel, and third, how it made her feel as a person, it sounds like a very significant case. But how does this relate to food addiction as it affects other people, maybe people who might not be quite as severe but who have those same feelings or similar feelings of being out of control?
Well, I think that she really depicts a, you know, she represents this picture and does a really good job, and I appreciate her willingness to do that, because that is part of the difficult thing in working with people who have eating disorders, is they don't want to talk about it because it is such a secretive thing. For people who have these urges to eat, more than what they need to, and being secretive, it's just a really difficult thing. I'm not really sure that I understand your question completely in terms of other people, because there is kind of a fine line, and I think that Marty, who you had on earlier, I could hear a little bit of what he was saying as far as what differentiates someone who eats more than they should and food addiction. It really is when you start to have some of these other consequences that you start to face and still continue eating.
What I really meant was, it sounds to me, and maybe I'm wrong, that what Vic has been going through was an extreme case. How extreme was it, and what, you know, and you hinted at this, what makes someone an addict as opposed to a social overeater?
Sure, and to be honest with you, I don't really think Vic's case is too far from most of the cases that we work with here at our center. I don't know if maybe Vic, if she's has been in treatment, if she could speak to maybe some of the other people that she knows, but her case really does just seem like one of the, just if I can use the word, normal cases that we see here quite often with someone who truly has food addiction. It is this severe. And I think that kind of helps us see that line between those of us who do splurge and have some extra cookies one night, as opposed to somebody else who does a lot of planning and has a lot of anxiousness in being able to find time to eat alone.
Vic, was that a critical part of what you were doing, is eating alone? You mentioned, you know, not waiting, not being being eager to get people out of the house so that you could get back to eating. Was it really a secretive behavior?
It was. It wasn't, you know, I've given you a sketch of how it was in the latter years. When I was younger, I would have these binges or benders, you know, in the evening or on the weekends or something, but my life wasn't bankrupt. But by the end, but even then, my benders, my binges were in secret. Typically, I would carry the food into my bed and eat it in bed after everybody else was asleep.
Let's talk about recovery. You have been in recovery for some time.
Yes. 17 years.
So what does that mean to you, and how has it changed your life? What does it mean to be in recovery, and how have you changed in those 17 years?
Oh, wow. I would like to, I'm almost crying when you ask me that question, because it's like, it's release from a self-imposed prison. It's, oh my gosh, my life is completely, completely changed. It's such a joy. I mean, you know, even when I was a youngster, I'm 66 now, even when I was a youngster in college, I remember waiting in the cafeteria line, and just people I hardly knew would say to me, "Don't you ever smile? You know, oh, you wear such a frown." And I hated here. You know, what business did those people have saying that to me? And now, that continued a lot. I was not a pleasant person to be around, I think. And I affected other people. And now I walk down the street, and perfect strangers, I pass people by, and they're smiling at me. And when that first started happening, I didn't know what was going on. And then I looked in a car window, you know, to use it as a mirror every once in a while, and I would notice that I was smiling. And so people, and I wasn't like smiling particularly at those people, it's just that I was beaming, and they could see I didn't want anything from them, and so they would smile back at me. And that's how my life is now. But, you know, the people whose lives I touch, I no longer bring out the worst in them.
Yeah, or in yourself. And Libby, what, you know, when you talk about being at an institute for addiction recovery and being a counselor, what are some of the things that you tell your clients to do or ask them to do?
Well, I like that Vic is talking about her recovery and paints a really beautiful picture of what someone can have. And so, you know, we really talk to them about a lifestyle change. It's really difficult when someone first comes in with their eating disorder or food addiction. And so one of the first things we have them do is meet with a dietitian, and we start looking at what are their, we call as trigger foods, those foods that are the most frequently used for binging. And then we try and remove those if we have anything like that. And for the most part, because we do treat for food addiction, our foods aren't going to be those types of foods. But there may be some that still can be a trigger for them. And so we first start looking at defining what is abstinence, what is a relapse. Because for someone who has a food addiction, they are in constant interaction with their drug. We have to have food to sustain us, and so it's a really important thing to be able to define what is abstinence, you know, what will recovery be, so that they can define it and not feel guilty for eating any food, because a food addict, unlike an alcoholic, can't just abstain from their drug completely.
So when it comes down to it, I'm going to ask each of you this. Is it important to deal with this as a serious addiction for America, where we have so much obesity? And you're going to have to, unfortunately, just wrap it up very quickly. Is it important, Libby?
I think it's absolutely important. I mean, you know, overeaters present with moderate to severe obesity, with an average binge eater probably being somewhere about 60% overweight, and I see that there's this trend. I think we need to be aware of how, you know, there's lots of different addictions people throw out there. I think that we all just need to be aware of these things, that there is the potential for this, because food is something that we often use as a coping skill, and it can become very dangerous.
Vic, do you think it's important for other people to know about this?
For other people to know about
the importance of treating food addiction?
Well, that's why I volunteered to be on this program, because I really like what I've heard about this on this program today of the description of the food addict. And for me, the vehicle for recovery was Overeaters Anonymous, a 12-step program.
Okay.
And I think that by being on the air, you're performing this service.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you, Vic, and also Libby Beer of the Illinois Institute. This month, we're looking at addiction in America. Today, we're going to talk about how illegal drugs cross paths with the criminal justice system. Our regular contributor, Judge Lynn Toler, is now the star of TV's Divorce Court. But in the early 90s, she was a municipal court judge in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, and she saw her share of drug-related cases. Hi, Judge.
Hi, how are you?
I am great. So, you know, when we talk about drug addiction, particularly in Black America, we have to talk about crack cocaine. And when that form of cocaine hit low-income neighborhoods in the 80s, it had all sorts of devastating effects. How did judges in the justice system respond?
I don't think they knew how to respond because I don't think they understood necessarily the mechanism that was at work there. When you're dealing with crack cocaine, it has a different, it was more powerful. It had a different neurological aspect and things that it did to the brain. So the severity of the problem and the quickness and severity of the addiction was not understood. And consequently, the response was not necessarily appropriate or addressing the problem that was there.
What do you mean by that? The response?
Well, the response was in the mid 80s, a little bit hysterical. They were talking about the tidal wave of crack use. They were talking about crisis and epidemic. And what they did was they responded with deep, serious, mandatory minimum sentencing for simple possession. And you could have a small amount of crack cocaine and go to prison for 5 years, as if simply being draconian was a response to the severity of the addictive potential that crack had. And what you did was you would put in a 22-year-old crack addict and just 5 years later get out a 27-year-old crack addict. Those neural pathways had not changed, nor had they addressed the new nature of the addiction that was sweeping across urban society.
You and I have talked a little bit about family law in different contexts, but I'm thinking about comedian Bernie Mac, who passed away recently, but he did a famous routine about his crack-addicted sister. He had to take care of her children. So when it comes to things like family court, what kind of ripple effects did it have there?
I think it has... One thing I do have to say, you know, Bernie Mac, is he used to always say, you've got one in your family. And I have seen addiction from both sides, from my side of the bench and the other side of the bench. And I've seen it through the criminal justice system and come out the other end in a situation that worked and one in a situation where it didn't work. So when you're talking about, you know, it having scope beyond, it's just not the other guy. And to the extent it's just not the other guy, I think helps us look at the problem in a more less reactionary manner. And family courts have cropped up because they realize, or the judicial system has realized, that a response to addiction, domestic violence, and a number of other problems has to deal with a number of layers of society and a number of aspects of behavior that is systemic within the family.
Now, you saw your share of drug possession charges, but I'm guessing there's also cases that involve crimes that were motivated by addiction. I mean, someone said to me once in New York, you know how sardonic New Yorkers are, I'm glad heroin is back because crack addicts stole my TV. So tell us about, you know, kind of the side crimes.
I think that was one of the reasons why crack got such a rapid and severe response, was because crack, not unlike meth these days, inspires behavior which is more violent than you would if you're smoking marijuana. In my court, I used to prefer marijuana smokers to drinkers, because drinkers get up. They get up, they get angry, they have a whole lot of bravado, where marijuana smokers, I very rarely had that as the underlying cause for a domestic violence case. But drinking was another source. And it's the same dichotomy there, that crack and meth, they tend to lend more to violent crime or to crimes of possession, not possession, but of theft, that would upset society, because that creeps out beyond the borders of the addicts and it implicates them.
Give me one thing that you would like to see the justice system do differently regarding addiction.
I think that I would like to see in a penal system where they had a separate penal system for those people who have been convicted of drug crimes, nonviolent drug crimes, where they address the addictive nature of whatever they're on and have them on probation and ease them out of the penal system with very severe probation conditions, so you can address the addiction and the behavior and environment that invite continuing use, even though an addict is trying to change.
Well, Judge, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Always.
Judge Lynn Toler is the star of Divorce Court. She is also the author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. And she joined us from radio station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we live in a wired world. Now some folks are finding themselves hooked on high tech. Why is it so hard to unplug? We continue our addiction series with a look at technology and addiction. He's an ordained minister and a pioneering hip-hop star. We're talking about Joseph Simmons, who is the run in the legendary chart-topping group Run DMC. The MTV generation knows Simmons as a devoted husband and father of six from his reality show Run's House, which also stars his wife, Justine.
Oh, Joey, wait.
What?
Diggy or Rusty didn't make the honor roll.
So both of them at the same time is having a problem?
Well, but it's not just... just the
there's something
Diggy.
That's going on
Diggy's
in the house
talking.
That's making them
Diggy's
not
talking and not being focused.
So that got to be something that we're doing wrong if both of them at the same time didn't make the honor roll.
Something you're doing.
Why do you keep blaming it on me? It's something you're doing or something we're doing. Let's take responsibility and put it on them.
I didn't do nothing different.
Oh, you know what I'm going to do? Instead of blaming you and blaming me, we'll just start fixing it. It's your fault.
I heard you, Joe. It's not funny.
The couple has written a new book on parenting called Take Back Your Family, A Challenge to America's Parents. Both Rev Run and Justine Simmons joined NPR's Tony Cox to talk more about the book and their TV show.
Well, you know, for me, this whole thing is a ministry. You know, as I'm Reverend Run, you know, I was telling everybody, this is a ministry. This is a way to touch people in America and all over the world through MTV. So when I'm on the television and I'm doing the words of wisdom in the tub at the end, or I'm talking to my son in his room about something, I'm letting you into my home to see how I would handle a situation with Russie if he broke his Game Boy, or with Diggy if he wasn't doing well in school, or with my wife if there's something that's going through us. So the cameras would be in the bedroom and I know I'm going in there to handle something that we're going through, and you would just be on the end of what's going on in my house and how I handle it. So that's how this show works. It was intentionally not only for me to have a reality show, but for me to show you my ministry, and my ministry happens to be to the family.
But you're an entertainer, experienced entertainer, and you are used to being in the public eye. Mm-hmm. Are your children, they are probably now, but were they as this began?
They were a bunch of hams at the beginning. It was very shocking. The cameras came on, and they loved it, and they're asking now every season, like, we get another season? We get another season?
Yeah.
But we were in church a lot. They understood the point. We didn't just throw this at them. When we first told them about it, we said, this is what we're doing. This is our service to the world. It wasn't like we're going on television to become big stars. That's why the show comes off as it does. We're going on television to serve. We're going to show them how we run our household. We're going to show everybody in the world how we get over, how we have blended families, how we handle situations. We're going to show them why our family works. And they were like, got it. That's what it was about.
But also, people also loved the show and felt like they were a part of us when they see us.
You know, you want to peek inside a rock star's lifestyle, but then that high dives off quick.
I understand. Let's talk about the book, Take Back Your Family. The title makes it sound as if this is a way to help you get your family back to the situation or back in the standing that they should be.
Take back means to me, you're taking it back from all the things out there that could be distraction. You want to take them back from the streets and put them in school. You want to take them back from worrying about the opinions of their peers to your opinion. You want to take them back. For me right now, I have to make sure that since my kids become stars, that Vanessa and Angela aren't looking to Us Magazine to validate them. Don't give away your powers. I'm constantly telling my kids, your power is not within if we have another season.
One of the things in the book that I read that caught my eye, Rev, was you talked about your experiences with Run DMC and how that when that came to an end, you sort of hit the bottom emotionally and otherwise, and that sort of precipitated your going into the ministry. Is your life now opposite of what it was
when
you were
doing
pop music?
I'm on tour with Kid Rock. It's not the opposite at all. I'm signing books during the day, and I'm rapping at night. How that came back about, I don't know. But God came, like, he showed me, I've made you a rapper also. You know, you don't get so caught up in the ministry that you don't rap. People enjoyed that. When I got to a place where things were changing for me, you go where you're celebrated, not where you're tolerated. But I'm still Run. When you see me out on stage, you'll say, that's not the same guy that was just preaching. He's screaming all these crazy lyrics and doing my Adidas. It doesn't look like the same guy that's going to be sitting here talking to you about family principles. Mm-hmm. So some things have changed, but basically, I am the Reverend Run. So I'm the Reverend, and I'm still Run.
Now, does he write the words of wisdom, or do you help him write them?
No, he writes them. Well, what happens is he gets up early in the morning before everybody. He gets in a tub. And, I mean, that's where, I guess, he finds his peace or whatever. And he reads the books, he reads the Bible, and then it's like God gives him what word of the day. And or sometimes it's whatever he's going through. And it's funny because a lot of people will write back, oh, my God, that was right on point. I needed that word. And then he'll have me probably read it over or something like that.
Two more things I want to ask you. I appreciate both of you coming in. It's really an interesting conversation to me. One is this. Having been married myself, as I've told you a couple of times, I know that there are people who are married who will be listening to this or who are in relationships or have been in relationships who will say, well, that's great for Reverend Run and for Justine. You know, they can do that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, life is hard for us. And, you know, it's just not all easy and all fun and like they're describing. So good for them, but that ain't going to happen for
me. We lost our baby on television. We go through hell. We showed the happy side, and we brought the cameras in the house when she lost the baby after 8 months. We went into the hospital. We don't just show a happy life. Everything that goes on in our house is game. We've showed it all on MTV. And I'll argue with her, but I realize at that moment, or she'll realize at that moment, okay, she's not agreeing with me.
Yeah.
One of us are going to have to back down.
No, you keep saying that, babe.
I
was
still
something.
Okay.
Anyway, we will argue, but it's like, it's an argument that you know that's getting ready to end. Like, not an argument. Don't look at me like that.
I'm finished because you cut me off. Go ahead.
Oh, my God, because you've been talking every minute. I want to say something.
Finish your point.
What we're saying is, like, we'll argue, but it'll be, we know this is not, you know, you're not going to go to bed like this. You know, whereas
the Bible says don't do that.
But as younger, I didn't always feel that way. You know, if I was mad, I was mad. You know what I mean?
I'm older, and I don't always feel that way now.
Exactly. But I'm not even thinking divorce. I feel like a lot of people just all of a sudden, as soon as things don't go right, they're like, you know what? I'm going to just leave. Like, you know, and I might have thought that years ago or felt like that years ago. But I'm learning this argument. Okay, so let's get on with it. Like,
you know what I find? And I like the question that you're asking. It's very important. And then I'm going to speak this directly to you. The thing that stops relationships from happening, the Bible talks about it's two becoming one. And in order to become one, you have to have the same ideas. In order to have the same ideas, you're going to have to give in a lot. For me, I want my marriage very badly. So happy wife, happy life. So if I'm right or wrong or whatever, I'm willing to just shut up and go into the other room and read the newspaper because I don't want to be right more than I want my marriage. So ego says, I want to be right. So I'm going to tell you what you did today with the kids, with this is wrong. That doesn't work for a marriage. One of you have to back down. I've made it, and she backs down, but I'm saying I've made it my decision to back down. It doesn't feel good at all.
I'm looking at her right now.
I said that we both back down. That's the thing I say every day.
Okay, no, I just don't want it to make it seem like...
No, I said you back down or I back down, but I'm talking about, okay. I'm speaking for myself, honey.
Okay. I just don't want to make it seem like you back down more.
I'm speaking for myself. I can't speak for you. I'm talking about since I want my marriage.
I'm just checking.
See, this is a real marriage.
Yes, it is.
You know, this is what marriage is.
But the key is, how bad do you want your marriage?
And the only way it's going to work, so I'm not trying to be angry all the time. And I'm trying to make him happy. And I will do things that I know he would want to do instead of doing what I want to do. Like, you know, we give in, you know?
I understand. Let me ask this as my very last question, Reverend Run. I really do appreciate this. It has been enlightening and a wonderful conversation. You end your show in the tub. We don't have a tub here.
Okay.
And we don't have any bubbles.
Because he would get in it.
You know, we don't want you to do that.
He lives in a tub.
I bet. It's a nice looking tub, too.
Thank you.
But what we want is...
I can give you today's word. You want today's word?
Today's word.
Learn how much you're worth was the subject. It's very important that while you're negotiating your way through life to find out how much you're worth, you must keep a scorecard. Remember small victories. Keep trophies, news clippings. Read the Bible. God will confirm how much he cherishes and loves you. Remember this. In business, people will very seldom tell you how great you are. Why? Because then they have to pay for it. God is love, Rev Run.
Reverend Run, Justine, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
That was Justine Simmons and her husband, Reverend Run, speaking with NPR's Tony Cox. Their new book is called Take Back Your Family, A Challenge to America's Parents. You can catch the entire family on their MTV reality show, Run's House. Video of this interview can be seen at our website, nprnewsandviews.org.